content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to the April 2013 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This monthly program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. Now, the Friends group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you would like to join the Friends group yourself, we'll have information on how you can do that later on in this program. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. And the library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and cassette. And, of course, all the services are available absolutely free. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. If you are not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of the program just for you. Now, this month, we will take a look at the most popular books checked out during the month of March 2013 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and the Physically Handicapped. We begin our program this month with a very, very popular author that you know well. The Racketeer is a legal thriller novel written recently by John Grisham. It was actually released on October 23rd in 2012, and it was one of the best-selling books of 2012 and spent several weeks atop various bestseller lists. Now, here's the plot. The African-American protagonist, Malcolm Bannister, a former United States Marine, had been an attorney in a modest Virginia small-town law firm. A real estate transaction, which he undertook in good faith, turned out to have involved the purchase of a secluded hunting lodge where a crooked Capitol Hill lobbyist invited corrupt congressmen for orgies with underage girls. Now, when the scandal was exposed, Bannister was caught up in a big FBI sweep. His name was added to many others on a 100-page racketeering charge sheet, his protestations of innocence ignored, and he got a 10-year prison term via the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, also known as RICO. The plot starts 5 years later, with Bannister halfway through his term, disbarred, divorced by his wife, losing his son, and nursing a bitter grudge against the federal government in general and the FBI in particular. He gets his chance when the brutal murder of a federal judge and of the judge's mistress gets the headlines and the FBI investigation gets nowhere. Bannister does know not only who killed them and why, but also what had been in the judge's safe and what had been the judge's own hidden corruption. But he is only willing to help solve the case if he is set free. Now, this Bannister achieves by the middle of the plot, dictating his own terms to the FBI. However, Bannister's revenge on the U.S. federal government is far from complete. By the end of the plot's very complicated twists and turns, Bannister, who had been imprisoned for a crime he did not commit, manages to commit several real felonies and manipulate the FBI into granting complete immunity to himself and several Confederates and let them keep very considerable proceeds. Commentators have noted that The Racketeer is unique among Grisham novels in that the main protagonist, Malcolm Bannister, is African-American. Grisham has stated that this came about after many years of fans encouraging him to feature a black hero. But according to him, it's no big deal. It's not about race. Again, the book is the latest from John Grisham called The Racketeer, and it's available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now, from John Grisham, we'll move on to another very popular mystery writer whose name is Lee Child. I'm sure he is also familiar to you. And this is another in a series of the Jack Reacher novels. It's called A Wanted Man. Now, perhaps in sly response to a movie that will feature a lot of action, Mr. Child begins A Wanted Man by confining Reacher to very close quarters. In fact, the first 125 pages of this new novel are about a car trip. After waiting exactly 93 minutes on the eastbound ramp of a Nebraska highway, he successfully hitches a ride. The car contains two men and a woman, and Reacher knows nothing about them. Being Reacher, he will spend those first 125 pages observing every detail, watching every move, trying to deduce as much as he can. His enormous size counts for nothing during this part of the book, nor does his appearance, although he has a busted nose and is said to resemble a very un-Cruise-like gorilla with its face smashed in. And he has no opportunities to resort to his tactic of choice, which is, of course, extreme violence. So he rides along an endless straight road through Iowa, thinking about codes and signs and numbers and letters. He is a math guy, actually, at heart, and he isn't likely to meet anyone equally wonky until his series takes him through Silicon Valley. On the road, Reacher gradually figures out that the men, Alan King and Don McQueen, are kidnappers. Their hostage is Karen Delfuenzo, a terrified waitress whose car they have hijacked. Reacher arranges to drive the car with Karen in the seat behind him so that they can make eye contact in the rearview mirror. Improbably, Karen starts blinking and twisting her head to deliver some kind of secret message. Now, even more improbably, Reacher cracks her code almost immediately and finds out what she is trying to say. A third of the way into A Wanted Man, his only acts of violence have been hypothetical. Now, it was technically challenging to take out a guy in the front passenger seat while driving at 80 miles an hour, he muses while at the wheel. Also, the 6'5" Reacher has arms so long that he would need to keep his elbow bent. He wants to slug his passenger, not punch out the car's side window. In any case, it's time for Mr. Child to get him out of the car and unleash him on the book's assorted evildoers. Outside the car, meanwhile, a wanted man has been developing one of the best female characters in the whole Reacher series, Julia Sorensen, an FBI special agent from Omaha who is called in to investigate a potential interstate crime. Once Reacher is sprung from the car, he encounters Sorensen, who ought to be his natural adversary, but she, like all the women who interest Reacher, is as smart and methodical as he is, and he impresses her with his irrefutable, conveniently self-serving logic. Now, he easily convinces her that whatever is unfolding, he and she should be on the same side. Reacher's banter is usually more elegant than it is in A Wanted Man. He can do better than this, which he aims at a trucker who is bothering him. Option 1, get back into your truck and get breakfast 50 miles down the road. Or option 2, get in an ambulance and get breakfast through a plastic tube. Still, the sang-froid of his delivery is what makes the big impression, and anyone worried about Reacher on screen can rest easy. Just remember how dauntingly Mr. Cruise can deliver that kind of dialogue, how greatly the character's intelligence outshines his brawn, and how formidable Reacher would be even if he didn't tower over everyone around him. Size doesn't matter, as you will see in December. Since Mr. Child's titles tend to be so generic, number 18 will be Never Go Back, A Wanted Man is best thought of as the one with the car ride across the Midwest. But it eventually expands into something gigantic, a scheme involving an alphabet soup of federal agencies and the obligatory foreign terrorists operating on American soil. Quick action and solid detective work elevate the second part of this book until it segues into one of the best of the series' climactic assaults. the expected wildly over-the-top moment when Reacher must single-handedly penetrate some kind of huge, geometrically interesting, top-secret, high-security fortress. This book's version of that structure is described with clarity, and Reacher, who has been idly showing off his familiarity with Midwestern area codes, soil content, and urban population counts, snaps into murderously good form. In this book, he seems newly thoughtful about mortality, particularly his own. Now, Reacher's vigilante ethics, a la Dirty Harry's, are likely to fuel much more controversy in a movie than they do on the printed page. But these smart, breathless books have no trouble justifying their hero's acts of vengeance. And A Wanted Man is more ingenious than other Reacher books have been about the underground activities Reacher is thwarting. Mr. Childs' endings would be even better if his book's worst bad guys, besides being swarthy and disposable foreigners, were given tough guy talents of their own. And that was about A Wanted Man, the new Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child, also now available from the North Carolina Library for the print and visually handicapped. Now we will turn to a review of a very, very popular book, and then one that was popular at the North Carolina Library for the Blind during the month of March, a book called Killing Kennedy, The End of Camelot. The book was written by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard, and we're going to read a review that was done by Janet Maslin. According to a 60 Minutes Vanity Fair poll released just recently, 7% of Americans think that Lee Harvey Oswald is the guy who shot Abraham Lincoln. That's one justification for Killing Kennedy, the latest gerund-happy book by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard, after, as you may remember, Killing Lincoln, to turn a presidential assassination into a human interest story. Now, this brand of highly dramatic nonfiction sells, and for good reason. The books are punchy. They are blunt and clear, not being burdened with an overload of pesky footnotes. But they do favor facts, and the more numerical, the better. This book's description of the shooting of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas includes the numbers 156, which is the car wheelbase in inches, 350, its horsepower, SX-100X, the car's Secret Service code name, 120 degrees in the angle it must turn in Dealey Plaza, 1233, the time when shots were fired, 14, the number of doctors attending to the dying president, and 12, bloody red roses stuck to his body. All that's missing is a partridge in a pear tree. Well, most of Killing Kennedy is immersively written in the present tense, with occasional prophetic little-does-he-know glimpses of the future. It begins on Inauguration Day, when the man with fewer than 3 years to live has his left hand on the Bible. Little does he know that Chief Justice Earl Warren, who swears him in, has a name that will one day be synonymous with Kennedy's own death. The authors are not content to say that January 20th, 1961 is a cold day. They must point out that a brutal wind strafes the crowd, and they are not content to remain in Washington. The book quickly switches to a meanwhile mention of the future gunman. Approximately 4,500 miles away in a Soviet city of Minsk, an American who did not vote for John F. Kennedy is fed up. They write, massaging the fact that Oswald was at that point fed up with the Soviet government, not with America's new president. The details of the Kennedy assassination are even more familiar than the story Killing Lincoln told. So Killing Kennedy has a momentum problem. It is lively, but not innately suspenseful. The authors combat that by packing in as much volatile language as possible. It is not surprising to find both splattered and shattered uttered in the same paragraph here. More extreme are examples of word mangling like this. The president's voracious sexual appetite is the elephant that the president rides around on each day and every day while pretending that it doesn't exist. An elephantine first libido is something that the men writing this book seem to admire, though they do show some restraint. And their vision of a heroic Kennedy runs much deeper, as with their harrowing replay of the sinking of PT-109 and the young Kennedy's efforts to save his crew. Still, Killing Kennedy cannot resist mixing an account of Kennedy swimming through barracuda-filled waters with the news that these menacing creatures are rumored to swim up out of the blackness and bite off the genitals of passing swimmers. Kennedy's lifelong habit of swimming naked comes in handy here, too. Without pants, the book points out, he is surely an inviting target. When it comes to Kennedy's decision-making during the Bay of Pigs invasion, the authors are more disapproving. The book also offers thumbnail accounts of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Civil Rights Movement, and the escalating Vietnam War. But Killing Kennedy is mostly about the man himself, with emphasis on his health, his marriage, his dealings with his Attorney General brother, Bobby, and his love for his children. Scintillating? No. But sneakily dramatic? Yes. At one party, the president is said to gaze flirtatiously at a young woman half his age who wears a coy smile and a dress with a plunging neckline. She turns out to be Lisa Gherardini, Da Vinci's model for Mona Lisa, at a time when the painting is on loan to the White House. In their endless search for convenient contrasts, the authors come up with this. But Lisa Gherardini has been in the grave for almost five centuries. There is no way she can be shot dead. The same cannot be said of the president. That is why the Secret Service never lets down its guard. Not yet, at least. However shameless it may be, the book picks up strength as it heads for its date with destiny. Those fascinated with grassy knoll conspiracy theories or the parallels to polarizing present-day politics will not want anything to do with this version. But Mr. O'Reilly and Mr. Dugard, like Stephen King in his alternative history novel, January 22, 63, succeed in investing a familiar national tragedy with fresh anguish. Although their sources range from highly reputable William Manchester's Death of a President, Sally Bedell Smith's Grace and Power, to iffy and presumptuous authors like Donald Spanto, J. Randy Taraborelli, and Edward Klein, and include many online videos and museum sites, they are all brought together to form a powerful historical précis. Apparently, 7% of Americans would do well to read it. The book is called Killing Kennedy, and it was written by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. And we just read from the commentary about the book by Janet Maslin. And you're listening to the April edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to a book called Montana by Debbie McComber. Her grandfather wants her to move home, and Molly thinks she just might do that. His ranch will be a good place for her sons to grow up, a place to escape big city influence. Then she learns from a stranger named Sam Dakota that her grandfather is ill, possibly dying. Molly packs up the kids without a second thought and makes the long drive to Sweetgrass, Montana. Once she arrives, she immediately has questions about Sam Dakota. Why is he working on her grandfather's ranch? Why does the sheriff trust him? Just who is he? Despite everything, Molly can't deny her attraction to Sam until her ailing grandfather tries to push them into marriage. Moving to the state of Montana is one thing. Entering the state of matrimony is quite another. Some borders aren't so easy to cross. And that's one of the latest books by Debbie McComber, and it's called Montana. Now we'll turn to a book by another popular author, Nelson DeMille's most recent smash hit thriller, The Panther, stars his returning hero, John Corey, one of the most skilled anti-terrorist operatives both at home and abroad. In this essay, DeMille himself fills in Corey's background, future, and possible demise. My fictional character of John Corey has appeared in six of my novels: Plum Island in 1997, The Lion's Game in 2000, Nightfall 2004, Wildfire 2006, The Lion 2010, and most recently The Panther, which was written just last year. When I first introduced Corey in Plum Island, he was an NYPD homicide detective on medical leave, recovering from wounds received in the line of duty. At the end of Plum Island, he's medically retired, and that's the last I expected to see of John Corey. My readers, however, according to DeMille, felt otherwise, and thousands of fan letters arrived asking to see Detective Corey again. Reviewers, too, liked the character and wanted to see more of him, so I gave him a second career in The Lion's Game and made him a contract agent with the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force, based on the Real Joint Terrorism Task Force. Now, this worked, and I also gave him a new wife, Kate Mayfield, a career FBI special agent whom he met on the job. Together, John and Kate are hunting down terrorists in New York City, around the country, and most recently in Yemen, in The Panther. The Coreys have gotten every bad guy they've ever been after, but there are no shortage of terrorists, and thus no shortage of plots and storylines for future John Corey novels. John and Kate and the author have job security. So what's next for Mr. and Mrs. Corey? Well, I was going to give them and me a rest and write something completely different for my next book. But The Panther was a critical and commercial success, debuting at number one on the New York Times and Publishers Weekly bestseller lists, as well as other bestseller lists. So, not wanting to break a winning streak, and again, listening to my listeners, I put aside what I was working on and began an outline for a new John Corey novel. Now, some writers, myself included, have ambivalent feelings about the popular character they've created. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for instance, got tired of Sherlock Holmes and famously got rid of him by having Professor Moriarty push Mr. Holmes over the Reichenbach Falls. I think Doyle was hedging his bets on that because even though a trip over that waterfall, which I visited, is almost certain death, we didn't actually see a dead body. As expected, Sherlock Holmes' millions of fans raised a ruckus, and also as expected, Conan Doyle gave in and resurrected his creation. I confess there were times when I wanted John Corey to meet a similar end, missing presumed dead, though resurrectable, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Why? Probably because I'm not as tired of him as I thought. If I really was tired of John Corey, it would show in the writing, and my readers and publisher would start to suggest that I retire Detective Corey or kill him off. But we're not there yet, so John Corey will return in my next book. Most of my readers like that John and Kate's adventure in The Panther took place in Yemen, a very hostile, dangerous, and dysfunctional country where American resources are thin or non-existent. The Coreys needed to survive in this environment while trying to accomplish their mission, which was to find the terrorist code named The Panther and arrest or kill him, then get out of the country alive. This foreign assignment was much different than anything John and Kate had done in the States, and it gave me a lot of opportunities to put them in life-threatening situations. The readers loved it, and so did the writer. So, in my new book, John Corey is off to another hellhole, Afghanistan this time. Why is he going there? Well, because Kate was sent to the capital city of Kabul on a temporary assignment. And while there, she, well, I don't want to give the plot away, but I'll say that Kate got into a bit of trouble in Afghanistan, and John is headed there to help her. That's what any good husband would do. I don't have a title for this book yet, but I'm pushing ahead with the research and just getting into the writing. So far, so good. Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires, but will it be the graveyard of John Corey? Maybe, but I'll make sure there's no body found just in case Detective Corey needs to reappear in a new adventure. And that's that book is called The Panther by Nelson DeMille. That's the latest of the John Corey novels, and there's a new one coming out that takes place in Afghanistan, and that was one of the most requested novels during the month of March from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now we'll turn to a very popular book by the author John Sanford. It's called Secret Prey, and here's the plot for this one. The company chairman lay on the cold ground of the woods, his eyes unseeing, his orange hunting jacket punctured by a rifle bullet at close range. Around him stood the four executives with whom he had been hunting, each with his or her own complicated agenda, and each with a reason not to be sorrowful about the man's death. If he read it in a book, Lucas Davenport thought, it would seem like one of those classic murder mysteries, the kind where the detective gathers everyone together at the end and solves the case with a little speech. But it wasn't going to be that easy, he knew. There were currents running through this group, hints and whispers of something much greater than the murder of a single man. He had felt this way not long before, since the curling of an indefinable evil, and not only had it nearly gotten him killed, it had lost him his fiancée, who'd never been able to recover from the violence of the encounter. Sometime soon, unless he could stop it, there would be another death, and then still another, and Davenport couldn't help but wonder if maybe this time the final death might not be his own. John Sanford has written extraordinary thrillers before, but nothing to top the startling twists and unrelenting suspense of The Secret Prey. The Secret Prey by the very popular mystery writer John Sanford. Now here's a word of interest from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Did you know that magazines are about to go digital? Well, thanks to all of our great patrons at the North Carolina Library for the Blind, the library has been selected to be one of the first in the nation to go digital in magazines. You can look for your subscriptions to national magazines on digital cartridge in the next few weeks. Some examples include Bon Appetit, The Atlantic, Consumer Reports, Ebony, ESPN, The Magazine, Good Housekeeping, The Ladies' Home Journal, National Geographic, and because I know that you are interested in books, The New York Times Book Review. You can find out more about what's available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And that's about all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, simply Google or search for the North Carolina Library for the Blind, or you can call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. You can also use the same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind. It is that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature every month on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long, until next time.